introducing two local St. Louis archaeologists. I have had the pleasure of being associated with myself for a number of years. They specialize in Near Eastern sites, have a great sensitivity to what we summarize as biblical archaeology as well. By training, they're both anthropological archaeologists. I'll let Mike explain what that means or does not mean if he cares to. You know, there are obviously subdivisions within the discipline with various accents. Mike Fuller here has his PhD in anthropology from Wash U, and his wife Nethery, where is she hiding right now? Okay, right back there. Okay. Yeah, Nethery has her master's also from Wash U. Presently, Mike is the chairman of the anthropology and sociology department. They've lumped those two together out at the Florissant Valley Community College. And his wife, Nethery, works with the Telecourse program out at Florissant Valley. You might be interested to know that Mike sort of cut his archaeological teeth at a site in Egypt called Tel Retaba that is one of the candidates for a site associated with the Exodus, probably either Pithom or Sukkoth, if debated, but one of the first stops at the beginning of the Exodus trek, and the excavations are still going on there. However, since then, he and Nethery together have worked in Greece, searching for the home of Ulysses in the Odyssey. That's being headed by another person from Wash U. Worked together in Jordan. I had the pleasure of working with them two summers there. They were there one summer before I was. And now they have started excavations at the site in Syria, Tel Tunanir, which I'll turn over to them and I'll let them tell you all about. So Mike and Nethery Fuller.
Thank you. When Horace and I were discussing about what we'd talk about today, it became pretty clear that he wanted it to be kept exciting, to be kept on time, and to be kept clean. So I guarantee that I'm very excited about this project, and I hope you can sense that and maybe get excited to be involved with us on it. I've got my watch up here in front, and I've taken the slides of the dancing girls out for us, so they don't have to realize that's part of archaeology also. An anthropological archaeologist is a person who has training in terms of excavation and analysis of the stones and the bones. While classical archaeologists are oftentimes more versed in terms of the critique of the sculpture and the paintings, and other types of archaeologists may be expert in the translations of the text and in their interpretations. My job and my training on this excavation in Syria is to oversee the laying out of the grid systems, the analysis of the architecture, the distinguishing of whether they're boys or girls when we're digging up graves and determining their age and sex and those types of things which fall in the realm of anthropological archaeology. Biblical archaeology to me is archaeology that's done in the Holy Land, archaeology that's done at sites that fit within the context of the biblical narrative, whether it's the Old Testament or New Testament. And I've always had a very strong interest in the sites I've worked at and seeing how they related to the stories of the Gospels and the stories of the patriarchs. If someone will flip the lights on the slide projector, what I want to do is show you a little bit of the work we did this last summer, digging in what I like to call sort of the middle of Mesopotamia. Right now there are three or four major American expeditions working in the area of Syria, working on sites in the area of the Tigris and the Euphrates River drainage areas, And it's really nice that St. Louis Community College, in conjunction with Concordia Seminary, are working at the site of Tel Tunanir. Nethery and I serve as sort of director and co-director, and we divide up some of the responsibilities in terms of who does the drawings of the architecture and who does the drawings of the pottery. Also in terms of who cracks the whip in the morning and who cracks the whip in the afternoon to make sure all the work gets done that's necessary. The project is located in northeastern Syria. And while today I'm going to be giving all the verbal descriptions, all of the computer-generated graphics, like the slide you're looking at here, are done by Nethery. That's one of her specialties. She is a whiz with the Macintosh and the Amiga computer systems. And one of the things that you wouldn't think about archaeologists having to do would be they have to be very computer literate today. It used to be 50 years ago, if you were back with Albright, the only thing you needed to know how to use was a pickaxe and a shovel and a whisk broom. But today, archaeological work requires for analysis as well as for presentation computer skills. And all the slides you see today are those generated by Nethery. Tel Tunanir is located in the northeastern half of Syria. You can see it up there in the yellow script. We have a lot of very famous neighbors. We're in a nice neighborhood in terms of some of the types of archaeological sites and discoveries. Important sites like Tel Brak, excavated and still being worked at. New excavations now, a UCLA crew at Tel Mozan, a Yale University excavation at Tel Leilan, Tel Halaf there to the west of us, a very important site excavated by the German archaeological mission before the time of World War II. You may also see the locations of some other important sites. Dura, Europus, and Mari are just downstream from us along the Euphrates. Further upstream, Raqqa is an Islamic period site, and the important location of Ebla. This part of Syria, I think, is going to be more and more a central focus for numbers of archaeological excavations for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's some large hydroelectric dam projects being constructed along the Habor River, and the site of Tel Tunanir will eventually be destroyed by one of these large projects. The other reason that there's going to be more and more work done in the area is I think some scholars are beginning to reevaluate where some of the narrative of the patriarchal stories took place. Recently, Menachem Mansour was in St. Louis and discussing with us some of the archaeological work related to Ebla. And he suggested that from one of the Ebla tablets, there's a discussion of a city of Ur near Haran, suggesting that in his interpretation, maybe the stories of Abraham at Ur is not Ur of the Chaldees, Ur lower down in the Tigris and the Euphrates area, but actually an Ur very much in this very northeastern corner of Syria in the area of Haran. The site of Tel Tunanir is one of 60 archaeological sites that's going to be wiped out in about the next 5 years when a large hydroelectric dam is completed. It's much like the Aswan Dam project that the Egyptians built on the Nile. We're basically racing the clock trying to get as much work done as we can before the dam's completed. Now I have my fingers crossed that this dam's going to hit snags, shortages of concrete, and miscellaneous other problems. In fact, I constantly say a prayer that the Bulgarians who are helping build the dam with the Syrians will have a falling out and maybe this project will be put on the back burner. So far, the Syrians have proposed 3 dams along the Habor. 2 of the dams will be finished next year on schedule. So I really have no reason to seriously doubt this final dam will also not be completed and may be completed close to schedule also. Tel Tunanir is on this map in large letters, not only because I'm a little egotistical about the site and its importance, but because it's also the biggest of the 60 sites in the area to be flooded. And it probably served as one of the major nodes, one of the major control points through a long period of time. Most of the mounds that are represented by little dots on that map and by names represent 3rd millennium BC sites. In fact, one of them represents the 5th millennium BC site, the site of Ziyada there, which was worked by a University of California, Los Angeles this last summer. Tel Tunanir is, I think, a really critical site in this area because it seems to represent almost a continuous occupation from at least the early Bronze Age all the way up into the Islamic period, roughly up to the time of the Crusaders. When we set down to write the final history of the chapter of this valley after the water has covered up all these cities. In many ways, it's going to be Teltun Anu. It's going to serve an important role to sort of fit together the sequences of occupations and to particularly tell the story of the later occupation of the valley during the Assyrian period, during the Greek period, Roman period, and Islamic periods. This is what Teltun Anu looks like today. It's a 60-foot high mound of earth that is all, from what we can determine, artificially brought there and constructed. Through long generations, city walls and houses were constructed at the site, and then through a combination of factors, sometimes warfare, sometimes simply natural factors such as floods or erosion, the buildings built out of mud brick dissolved, weakened, were knocked down, leveled off, and new buildings built on top of them. We have literally sort of a layer cake effect, what archaeologists like to call stratigraphy. And as we excavate, we're literally digging inch by inch through decades of time, moving from the top levels all the way down eventually, I hope, to the very basal deposits of the site. In terms of area, the big main tell covers an area about the size of probably four or five of the big buildings here on your campus. But that's only about one-fifth of the site area. The site's actually quite large. And even in this cotton field here, if you would go out to the level cotton field and begin to dig below the plants, you'll eventually begin to come up with remains of the city. What happened was there was the tell, the citadel, where the main elite stayed, where the temples were and palaces were. And then at different times during the city's history, the population was so large that expanded out around in sort of a donut effect. So we not only have the large landmark to work with, which is large and impressive on its own right, but even a bigger city surrounding it. As I said, what we're doing is something called rescue archaeology. And sometimes on the excavations, I had some of the students during the last summer sort of shaking their heads going, well, gee, when I read in the textbook about archaeological techniques, I never read about this shortcut. Well, one of the things we have with a big site, I mean, the total site area, as large as the seminary here, in only 5 years to excavate it, is we have to make some shortcuts. Sometimes we have to sit down and evaluate that one layer of the occupation may not be as critical to our understanding as others. So we may dig and record it fast. And then when we come down to a level that's more critical, we may slow down and spend more time. Instead of taking soil samples and floating the dirt for little seeds and snails out of every single bucket of earth, we may sit down and pick out only those which we feel are most critical and significant. One of my colleagues has been teasing me that what I should really do is get a bulldozer to the site and scrape off about the first 25 feet until I get to the third millennium, until I get to the early Bronze Age, which tends to be the most popular time period of my colleagues at UCLA and Yale. We're going to resist that temptation. We're digging our way down there slowly but surely. We ended up about 2000 BC this last summer. We are trying to recover and record as much as possible, because what we do not document at this site will be lost forever to scholarship and science. This is the crew during this last summer, and I bet you can pick out Dr. Hummel, and you might, some of you know John Bartsch over there. Standing next to John was one of our favorite students on the project this summer, Boris Bayless. Boris is the guy in black. And Boris is, was student body president last year at St. Louis Community College. An interesting sidelight. When we arrived, several of my Arab workmen looked at Boris and they said, "Mr. Mike, you brought a Shabab Aswad, a black man, or a Zinj, an African." And I said, "That's right." And they go, "How could you do this? They're such terrible people." And I said, "Well, why do you think they're terrible people?" And they said, "Well, we've seen all these movies made in the United States about how terrible black people are. And how you brought one of these and he's going to be a criminal and a drug user and a terrible person." Well, it turned out that Boris upset all of their stereotypes. A very bright young man, Baptist who doesn't smoke or drink or pinch women, and who also showed a tremendous affinity for picking up Arabic. And in fact, the workmen were teasing me that if Boris comes back next year, he'll soon know more Arabic than I know. And he really did pick up on the language very quickly. One of the things that's essential on an excavation like this is the ability to sort of work together as a group, and also to be able to work together well with the workmen. Because what happens on an excavation like this is I don't necessarily break your back. I don't give big calluses on your hands. I'll hire five or six Arab workmen to work with each one of the Americans who come over. And to a large extent, the success of the dig relates to the ability of all the Americans to interact with each other, as well as each student to be able to interact with the workmen who are assigned to them, and to be able to get the most out of the excavation square where they're digging. In front of me is Nethery, and in front of her is not an American. This is a gentleman who's quite a djinn. His name is Abu Farid Hassan Mamu. That's a mouthful. And Abu Farid is a Kurd, if you've ever heard of the Kurdish people. And he serves as sort of our all-purpose fix-it foreman. And if anything needs to be done that I don't have the time to do or I don't have the inclination to take care of, like figure out who's going to string the barbed wire around the excavation at the end of the summer, Abu Farid is the man who always solves these problems. He also has a talent that I'm very envious of. I think he speaks about 12 different languages, not only Arabic and English and Farsi and Kurdish and Turkish, but Japanese, Italian, German, French, and I'm sure if he ever has a chance to bump into a Russian, he'll pick it up very quickly. One of those people with a tremendous affinity for languages, which is useful because in this area of Syria, there are not only lots of foreign nationals working in terms of different expeditions, but also lots of different ethnic groups and different language families. Abu Farid has excavated for years at Mari. Some of you may be familiar with that very famous site in the French excavation. We're very glad to have him working with us on this dig. Oh, I'll go back for one other person here. A few of you may remember Ron Ball, who was a student here at Concordia and I think served on faculty here for a while. And he was with us during the summer, as well as Julene. Where's Julene? Several of you might even remember Julene, who's a graduate from the seminary. We had a very good crew this last summer. One of the interesting stories about Tel Tununir was a visit to the site by an early archaeologist named Podibard, described in a book that he wrote on the trace of Rome in the deserts of Syria. Podibard developed a unique way of visiting archaeological sites in this part of the Middle East. He would fly to them in an old biplane, and he would pick out the sites from the air that he wanted to visit. And this is what he saw as he flew across Tel Tununir in the early 1920s. He saw a very large central citadel up there, and then he saw other buildings and street patterns. It was very convenient for him to fly and land at the site because it kept him from being robbed. Apparently back in the 1910s and 1920s, there really was no government in this area except for the local Bedouins. And if they wanted to relieve you of your possessions, they apparently could. But in a biplane, you could simply take to the air as necessary. Now, you've probably seen the old Humphrey Bogart movies that were originally shot in black and white and now have been colorized. Well, Nethery's been colorizing Podibard. And so I'll use this slide every now and then to talk about different areas of the excavations. It's literally Podibard's photograph, which we've digitized and now assigned color values to it, so you can get a feeling for what the river and the cultivated valleys and the area of the site looks like. Let me tell you about three of the areas we were digging in this last summer, starting off with Area 1. Area 1 is a big step trench that we started along the side of the citadel during the summer of 1987. We deepened that trench and widened it considerably during this last summer's excavation. This is what the trench looked like during 1987, and this is what the trench looked like during 1988. And there's Dr. Hummel in there supervising the removal of soil. We were able to get this trench down in 1987 to a point about 200 years before Christ. From my analysis at the end of the summer of our pottery, I think we got the trench down to about 2000 BC. And my hope is during this next summer of 89, we can go back and considerably deepen the trench again and hopefully get it back to at least around 3000 BC. Taking down about 1,000 years, I guess, a summer worth of excavation. Here's Dr. Hummel with some structures that right now we're dating to the Iron Age that he uncovered, a mud brick wall, which you can see that he's perched on there, and then two large ovens that were probably bread ovens that have been uncovered. The soil from these was carefully removed and floated for the recovery of botanical materials. And right now we're waiting to see what another archaeologist at Texas A&M is going to have to say in terms of the identification of the types of seeds and charcoal we found inside that oven. One of the things we discovered in 1987 during the excavation of the trench was the corner of a house. And what we did this last summer in 1988 was go back and fully expose the entire structure. This is the plan of the upper phase of the house. It's an Islamic period house dated to the 13th century AD. And Julien was responsible for the excavation of this part of the house, and Ron Vall was responsible for the excavation of the upper part of the house. We sort of divvied up the rooms. And what we came up with was a very interesting building. This large central room probably had served as a diwan, sort of a living room, reception room. It was plastered along the margins, but the interior of it seemed to be sort of just a beat clay floor. Probably there had been a carpet that had laid on the interior of that, and the margins had been white plaster. There had been some kind of an installation over here in this corner, and we're still working on an idea of what that may have been. There were two storage rooms to the north of this, and then beyond that was an unroofed area where there was a bread oven. And you can see that bread oven there, which is described by the word tanur. That house was literally built directly on top of the foundations of an earlier structure. And what's fascinating is we're working now on sorting out the pottery from the earlier house, which is this one here, and then the later house, the one I just got through showing you, to understand some of the subtle changes in pottery decoration and styles and functions of pottery during the 13th century AD. One of our discoveries last year was a Hellenistic destruction level at a depth of around 18 feet beneath the surface. There's an old law in archaeology that is always on literally about the last day of the dig that you make one of your most important discoveries. And indeed, during the summer of 87, with about 2 days to go, one of my students started hollering, "Come over here and look at all this pottery I'm uncovering." And indeed, he had found what appears to be the wine cellar of a Hellenistic ruler at the site. The cellar had been looted, and the pottery vessels had been tossed out and broken. We were able to map these in and then reconstruct a number of them. Up on the top of that right-hand side, you can see a wine crater for mixing wine and water for a party. Below that, you can see a vessel called a pelaiki, which would be a very expensive wine container. I tell my students that would be sort of like Chateau Mouton Rothschild. Below that, you can see a pithoi, a large storage vessel for cheaper wine. That was the ancient equivalent of Gallo. And then below there, this is the pottery rest that the large storage vessel would sit into. Now, if you were entertaining faculty members who'd come to your house, what you would obviously do is open up the palaiki and mix the good wine in the water and serve the best. And if it was your friends in class, you would probably get the Gallo wine out and cut a little bit of the good and add some water and have your symposium with that type of a mixture. We were able to get a radiocarbon date on that level at 270 BC. Here's that large crater. It was a king-size crater, and we had a king-size student that summer, Mark Hartman, and so we posed him in the slide. As Horst began excavating this last summer, he went directly beneath that level of the Hellenistic destruction level. He got some interesting pottery material, which we're calling Nimrod stamps, a variety of pottery that had previously only been identified in Max Malawan's excavations at a very famous site on the Tigris River called Nimrod. As he dug deeper down below the Hellenistic material, he came into the Iron Age pottery. Much of it simple white wares, sometimes painted with a single strip of red paint going around the shoulder of a vessel. While we were sorting the pottery one day from the Iron Age material, we came up with a very interesting sherd. We came up with a piece of pottery that had an inscription on it. And the inscription is given in the Phoenician alphabet. Now, the inscription itself appears to be in Aramaic, but the style of the letters, the form of the letters, are those which we oftentimes associate with the Phoenicians. This is what the inscription looks like. Now, since we found the piece of pottery floating in the Iron Age deposits, my assumption was it was an Iron Age period Phoenician inscription. Indeed, this is what the vessel looked like. It was a large open bowl, and it had one line of text on the interior of the vessel, and it had one line of text also on the rim. Now, we only found one chunk of this, about the size of your hand, and you better believe that for the next day or two after that, Horace and I carefully culled through all the pottery sherds, hoping to find another two or three pieces so we could complete the inscription. But this was the only fragment of it we found. Towards the end of the summer, I decided that we really needed to have some kind of an idea on how old this inscription was. This last year was a big conference and museum display on the Phoenicians in Venice. And so on the way home, Nethery and I detoured through Venice. That's a nice place to detour through, by the way, after you've spent 2 months in Syria. And all that water and all that good food, it's quite lovely. As we were in Venice, we stopped and we did some comparison. There have been charts produced on the evolution of the Phoenician script through time. You can see various letters have changed style and stance, the older forms here, the more recent forms here. Based upon what we could determine, we had estimated an age for the inscription that Horace found as probably being around 1000 BC to 900 BC. We were very pleasingly surprised to find out at the Chicago meetings of SBL, ASOR, that analysis was wrong. And Kyle McCarter, who's president of ASOR, looked at me and he said, "You've missed it by about 200 years. And I assumed that I had overestimated its age. I was wrong. I had underestimated its age. This is apparently the inscription we found this last summer is a late Bronze Age, one of the earliest West Semitic alphabetic inscriptions that have come to light so far." And Kyle McCarter is very excited because right now people are beginning to reconsider what the age was for the origins of the alphabetic script and where it originated. Part of the reason they're interested is our inscription from Tel Tunanir is not too far away from another similar inscription that had been found in this large statue. This statue was found when a man was bulldozing along the edge of a tell near the Turkish border. The tell is called Tel Fekeriya. Inscribed on this statue is, in both cuneiform and in Aramaic, a text describing a ruler, Hadad Yis'i, who's king of Guzan and Sykan, and it has all the standard sort of king bragging about how good it is and how Hadad is going to look after him. This has been a very difficult inscription for archaeologists to date because the style of the statue and the Assyrian inscription on it had led them to believe it was around 1300, 1200. But the Aramaic script on it, using the Phoenician type characters, had always thrown people off, and they had decided to date it quite a bit later. Now, apparently, both this statue and our inscription both tend to fit into what new scholarship is looking at as probably the late Bronze Age, fairly intensive use of the West Semitic alphabet, and one of the earliest occasions in this part of northeastern Syria. One of the interesting things is that we have other evidence to indicate that the site was occupied during that time period, roughly 1200 to 1400 BC. One of the pieces of evidence for that is a small little clay handmade figurine that was discovered in the very deepest levels of that Area 1 test trench. Now, the one we found was very weathered and broken, but I can show you almost an identical parallel, this one here and that one there, from the Telmescane excavations by the French along the Euphrates, a site of ancient Emar. There they've dated these also to the late Bronze Age, roughly to the same time period apparently as that inscription was when the inscription was originally executed. We've also found at the end of the excavation in that deep trench fragments of an incense stand or altar. Now, the ones we found were little corner fragments, like this and like that corner there. This one I'm showing you is again from the French excavations at the site of Emar along the Euphrates. The ones which we found match it almost identically in style and execution. I can say that because Nethery and I went to the Louvre Museum to look at the ones from Emar at the end of the summer to confirm that indeed we've gotten down into late Bronze Age deposits and apparently have a very sizable late Bronze Age occupation at the site. When you think about sites in Mesopotamia, you oftentimes think about cylinder seals and cuneiform inscriptions. During the summer, we found a cylinder seal, not this one here, but I wanted to show you what they look like in their rollouts. The seal which we found was out of a black stone, and it was extremely worn. We rolled out the image onto clay, and were barely able to pick out some of the details of what had been carved onto the surface of the cylinder seal. Let me show you Netherese's sort of computer enhancement of what the image is. It appears to be a winged bull with a crescent moon over its back being pursued by a hunter holding a bow in his arms. This style was very popular in this part of Mesopotamia roughly 900 to 800 BC. So we're very pleased to have this cylinder seal. One of the ironies of life was it was found leaning up directly against the foundations of a 13th century AD Islamic house. And apparently when the Arabs had dug the foundations for the house and some other installations, they had penetrated deep into the site and brought this thing up in the disturbance of the fill. That's why you always have to be careful about your dating of architecture by the associated finds in conjunction with it. This is an example of a similar type of seal from another site. You can see a little bit better detailed, a winged bull, a hunter, and in this case there are several other figures in the seal also. There's some interesting parallels between some of the Iron Age deposit material that Dr. Hummel was digging through this last summer and material that French had excavated from a site called Tel Barsif, which is also along the Euphrates, a little south and west of Tel Tunanir. Barsif had yielded some interesting things, including this stele to a Hittite storm god. There's one of those in there, Horace, if we can just dig a little deeper in Tunanir or spread out a little further on. Barsif also was famous because a couple of buildings, apparently it served as local governor palaces, had been decorated with frescoed scenes, showing you what apparently court and palace life looked like during the 9th and 8th centuries before Christ. This is actually one of the pieces of fresco that the French moved to the Louvre, a piece of Assyrian painting dated roughly 850 BC. Let me tell you about some of our excavations in Area 2 and some of the things that were discovered there. John Barich, who's one of your student body, was involved in some of the Area 2 excavations. Area 2 is up on the crown of the tell, a very broad, flat, level area. We set up a grid system consisting of 16 excavation units, each one of these measuring 5 by 5 meters, or roughly 15 by 15 feet. We dug all of these down to a depth of around 6 to 7 feet beneath the surface, at which point we uncovered a very well-preserved occupation level. Before we got down to that well-preserved occupation level, though, everybody had a nuisance to deal with, and the nuisance was a cemetery. The local Bedouin population have probably planted several thousand bodies into the upper levels of the site, and on a daily basis for about the first week or two of the excavation, everyone was constantly producing skeletons. Some of these skeletons were maybe 100 to 150 years old. Some of these skeletons looked like they were about 10 to 12 years old. In fact, one of them had a coin associated from 1960 with it. Luckily, none of these skeletons have headstones. So the workmen can't be too unhappy. They know we're digging up relatives, we just don't know whose relatives we're digging up. What we do is we carefully identify the sex and the age of the individual. This is a very robust male in his 30s. We look for any evidences of pathologies, diseases. We actually found what appears to be a bullet hole in one of them this summer. We record all those things very studiously. Then we take all the skeletal material out from the excavation area, out from the flood area, and we rebury it. And we allow the Muslim workmen to be involved in the reburial. So they feel good about it, and we feel good about it also. They keep on saying, you've come to desecrate our graves, and I say, no, we've come to get down below them and to find out what's there beneath it about the history of your culture and about the history of Christianity. Once we get down below that cemetery, we come up with very well-defined walls, plastered installations, floors of houses. We actually came up with what appears to be three city streets and about a half dozen houses scattered along those streets dated to the 13th century. We're able to say that based upon some of the ceramic material we found. Netherese likes to term this type of pottery Kmart greenware. It was apparently a locally available, cheap
material that still looks fairly attractive. And we found this vessel crushed on the floor of a house.
Here's a little fancier variety of Kmart green. This had Sgraffito design on the underglaze to it. It was probably not the blue light special, but the Christmas special. We were able to identify some more luxury wares, a little higher priced and indicative of a little more higher status individuals in some of the houses. We came up with material called Rocca Lusterware, and you can see that there was quite a bit more detail and time put into its execution and firing. We not only dig these things up and analyze them, we do very careful drawings of them, and then from the pencil drawings, take these back and computerize them at St. Louis Community College to produce the illustrations for the slides that you see here, as well as for our final reports. We even got some material called Rocca Molded Ware, and here's the computerized drawing of Rocca Molded Ware. If you've not had a class from Dr. Hummel, he maybe has not taught you how to read these types of drawings. On the right-hand side, you have the sort of Superman X-ray view of what the wall thickness and the interior of the vessel looks like, while on the right-hand side, you'll have what the exterior and its decoration appears like. We even got one piece of pottery that I don't think I've even told Horace about this, that right now we're going to identify as Kashan ware. And Kashan ware was produced in Iran. And it was a very high-quality luxury ware that was traded out and indeed would have been the possession of some of the most elite families at the site of Tel Tunanir during the 13th century AD. People oftentimes say, what's the strangest thing you find during a single season of excavation? Without a doubt, this piece of pottery, it's about the size of the desktop in front of you, was our oddest artifact during the summer. It immediately engendered considerable argument among some of the workmen. They were convinced that it could not be Islamic because here were the faces of lions and women and this sort of abstract human form represented on it. Indeed, they told us that the Quran does not allow things like this. But indeed, it was found within the Islamic deposits and it actually finds innumerable parallels from production sites along the Tigris River in modern-day Iraq. And again, represents a trade piece, probably coming from the Mosul area overland and used either in the mosque or in the home of the governor or an elite individual at the site of Tel Tunanir during the 13th century. Besides the pottery, we know that these upper levels are 13th century from the coin material, which we're able to read the inscriptions on and decipher the dates to. One of my favorite coins is this one here. For a while, we nicknamed him the Pinocchio ruler, because he's got that big snaz on him. Interesting story. For the most part, Islamic rulers did not put their images on the coins. It's very rare. Only during a brief period of Islamic history do you have the images of the rulers. It's during the time of the Crusaders, because the Crusaders showed up with coins in their pockets, and the coins had images of the rulers in Europe. And the Muslims didn't want to feel like they had inferior coinage. So for a while, they made these sort of Mickey Mouse portraitures. And when Saladin drove out the Crusaders, the coinage ceased having images of their rulers. Who's this guy? Well, here he is. He's one of the Zanjid rulers who was occupying a throne on the city of Sinjar, very close to where we're excavating. Jebel Sinjar is actually on the horizon, and we can see it from the dig. We found some bronze lamp materials, which also date to 13th century. We found a ring flask from the Islamic period, which is quite unique and very interesting. Now, one of the reasons we have all these things left behind for us is this gentleman here. You maybe recognize him. He doesn't have an American Express card. He doesn't need to have one. His name is Genghis Khan. He simply took whatever he needed, right? He didn't have to charge anything. And indeed, we know that Mongols swept through Syria at least on two different occasions. Probably this 1260 date came through the area and simply slaughtered everyone. They did not discriminate. Christians, Jews, Muslims, everybody got it when they came through. And they took what they wanted, and what happened was they apparently broke and left behind lots of the pottery, lots of these bronze coins, things which they were not interested in taking away as plunder. Let me tell you about one last area of the excavation, Area 3. This area is located on a small mound off of and away from the main tell. This is about 1,000 feet away from the main excavation, from the main part of the city. We had a small rise about half the size of this lecture auditorium that stood about 4 feet high. We had no idea what this was. We generated a couple of educated guesses, and then we started laying out a grid and digging into it. As we excavated, one of the first things we discovered was a doorway. And the Muslim workman looked at this and informed us that, congratulations, we had just found a mosque. Indeed, this type of a entryway with sort of a recessed plastered area and then a step over threshold does look remarkably similar to some of the entrances of the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus or in Aleppo. But something wasn't really quite right. The orientation of the building didn't jive. Some of the architectural features didn't really match up for what we expected as a mosque. Literally on the last day of the excavations, we had come out to do some final drawings and photographs. I was brushing off these bricks here on that sort of thresh area of the doorstep, and we made a very exciting discovery. We discovered that a faint inscription was found on one of the bricks, as well as the fragment of an equal arm cross. Several of us looked at the inscription, and we could not make it out as Arabic. That was for a good reason. It wasn't Arabic. It was a Syriac inscription, and indeed the Syriac translation says, "Hope." We pried this thing up out of the floor and drove to the nearby Syriac Orthodox Church in Hasakeh, where there's a bishop, and he looked at the inscription and suggested that it had probably covered the grave of a priest or a saint or a local martyr, and that indeed the structure which we're excavating may well be a church. Today there's still a very strong Syriac Christian population in this part of Syria, and it's really fascinating that the building which we've uncovered may have been one of their churches during the Islamic period. One of the problems, though, is that in the structure, we weren't finding what appeared to be church lamps. We were finding what looked more like the average domestic types of lamps that you find during the 13th century. And one of the architectural features we found was a detailed plaster piece along one wall that does not seem to be something that you'd normally associate with church architecture, but more with palace architecture. Whether this structure went through two phases of uses, or whether we have a palace that was built with robbed church parts, we won't know until next year when we go back and finish excavating the entire structure. We have tempting evidence to suggest that it may be a Syriac church at one point in its architectural use. When living at Tel Tunanir, we stay at the Tel Tunanir Hilton, located right there. And that's not as bad as you might think. We were able, by hook and by crook, to eventually get electricity in. That was one of our first concerns during the summer. And we now have probably one of the world's longest extension cords, literally running up to the houses all the way over there. The Syrian government said, sure, we'll give you electricity. Wait 2 years and pay $6,000. And so I decided that extension cords would do it quicker and for less cost. And so we've rigged ourselves up that way. We have a refrigerator, we have stoves, we have a very sizable dining hall and kitchen facility, and as well as dorm rooms and pottery processing rooms. We have two toilets. For those of you who like the porcelain throne type, like you have here at the seminary, we have one of those, as well as a Turkish john. We have two showers. We have almost all the comforts of home except no air conditioning and no television. We have some fans, and we have each other for entertainment, particularly food and produce, that we put up a highway sign for ourselves, as well as several other excavation crews have done the same. Well, the site right now is sleeping, and while I'm gone, it has two guards watching it to make sure no one's poking around and messing with it. They're also there to make sure no one's running away with my picks and shovels, my wheelbarrows, the cameras or computers or mini cams that are all part of the archaeological digs that's stored there. If you're interested in coming with us during the summer, you can come help awaken the sleeping giant and figure out what other mysteries and secrets that it has inside it. We are going back to Tel Tunanir during the summer of 1989. Right now, we're thinking about going back during the summer, during the spring of 1990. Now, I'll be real honest with you. If you're thinking about coming, it gets hot during the summer. Some of the days it gets up to 120, 125 degrees by around noontime. Now we quit at noon because of that heat, but it's still awfully roasty toasty. No humidity. It's not going to be like St. Louis. Can you imagine St. Louis 125 degrees during the summer? Everybody would die. It's warm, but it's not sticky. We'll be going 1989 during the summer, and right now we're thinking about 1990 for a spring excavation. So if you're interested in coming along, be sure and talk to Dr. Hummel. Be sure and come up and talk to me. Get an application form. I think that's all I've got sorted in for slides. Do you have any questions? Yes, sir.
Have you come up with a historical identification for the city that we're held?
Yeah, we have a real good identification for it during the Islamic period. It had the same name it has today, Tunanir. And it's mentioned in records all the way back. In fact, it's mentioned as being one of the areas messed up by the Mongols. We have a very good reason to believe, I'd say 99% confidence, that during the Roman period and the Greek period, its name was Thunurin, because Procopius and some of the other writers talk about a major city guarding the border between the Parthians and the Roman Empire along the Habor, and the descriptions of the city, its location, fit exactly the site of Tel Tunanir. In fact, no other large late period settlement exists in the valley. It really has to be Thunurin from all the historical analysis. Earlier than that, before the time of Alexander the Great, I'm not going to speculate on its identification, but there's some good possibilities.
Did Kyle McCarter think that inscription was in Arabic, in the Arabic language?
In Aramaic. In Aramaic, yes.
Would you think it's the oldest Aramaic?
One of the very oldest. I was twisting his arm at the ASOR meetings, saying, "Come on, Kyle, tell me what it says." And he said, "Why didn't you find some more lines of it, Mike?" And he promised me before Christmas vacation to give me an analysis of what the inscription may be referring to. He was not going to talk about that. What he was most excited about was the fact that it appears to be so early, quite a bit even earlier than I had assumed.
How do you go about getting a site to work with? Do you have to work with the government, and do you have to pay them rent? And is that site yours now? You're charged with the care of it?
Sure.
Obviously the guarding of it. Can you talk a little bit about how you, the preparation for getting into that?
Nethery and I sort of fell into this very good piece of luck related to some work we were doing in the Damascus Museum. And we were working on some materials related to my dissertation and getting permission to look at things and chatting with the Syrians about this and that. They said, "My gosh, you people are interested in late things, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I'm very interested in Christian period materials, Islamic period materials, and Hellenistic period materials." And they said, "Boy, virtually every American who comes to bug us are third millennium specialists." And they said, "We have a very big late period site. Would you consider looking at it and starting the work?" And so we were really invited by them to go out and look at the site. We were impressed by it when we saw it. We applied for the permit to the Syrian government, and they granted us the excavation permit. And no one else has rights to dig there. Unless we sign off and hand it back, no one can ever go and do any other work there. We have to work there at least every other year, or you lose that permit. You can't collect permits and just hang on to them. You basically have one and you have to keep working at it. We have to, every time we're working there, pay the salary of a local Syrian official who comes and checks on us every now and then to make sure we haven't found the gold of Troy and tried stashing it in Horace's suitcase, right? We have various assorted things which we have to cover in terms of cost of visas. We have to cover all of our workmen's salaries out of our budget. We have to cover all of our food, all of our transportation. The Syrians give us lots of smiles, and they try to make life as easy as they can, but their economy is a wreck. It's a shamble. And so if it wasn't, they'd be digging the site themselves, quite honestly. And so we have to raise all of our funding. We have to play by their rules. And they constantly change the rules a little bit. I was sort of disconcerted to find out at the Chicago meeting that they're changing the rules again on us, Horace. But we'll be able to get by. We'll make do. We do have to play. It's their country. It's their site. All the material which we find belongs to the Syrian government. And some years they're willing to let materials come out for study and analysis. Other years they're a little more hesitant. This year they were hesitant for various political reasons and things happening. At the end of the excavations, they may very well do a divvy up on some of the material. At the same time, I'm not going to lay money on that. I'll believe it when I see it, sort of the show me state attitude. All the money, by the way, for this project, we raised privately. None of this is NEH or NSF money. The seminary made a nice donation to help support the work, and we certainly appreciated that. If you ever see the name J.P. Green, there's a company in Mexico, Missouri that makes fire brick and glass products. They gave us $7,500, and that was the big boost in the arm that really made sure we got as much work done as we could this year. I spend a lot of my time, like I guess a good preacher does oftentimes, passing the hat at various organizations and getting down on my knees and saying, I've got a great cause, I can hear that change in your pocket. And indeed, at the art museum, I guess in about 2 weeks, I'll be there doing pretty much the same presentation, but putting a big punch in for the money to see if I can continue to at least match the amount of support we had last year, if not increase it. This is the type of site where you could easily spend $50,000 to $75,000 a year if you wanted to do a fantastic job and really uncover it to its greatest potential. We're operating at about 1/4 of that in terms of our budget, and I'm still very proud of what we were able to accomplish with the budget that we had.
Two things. One, maybe you can allay some of the students' fears that if they go on this dig this summer, they won't be kidnapped or hijacked or, you know, for the next 3 years in some cell, so that it's very safe. And then the other thing is, I'm interested to know how many students are interested, at least, in attending this summer.
Good question, Paul. We only recently ransomed John from Beirut, but he's a... No, we didn't lose anybody. Man, we didn't have any bad problems at all. One of the jokes is that, you know, people have this image of the entire Middle East as one giant war zone, and any American is a walking target. Well, indeed, if you want to go to Beirut, you can get in some big trouble. And if you want to go mess around in some sections of the West Bank or in Gaza and Israel, you can get yourself in some hot water also. But we are way off away from all of those problems. We don't spend a lot of time when we're in Damascus or Aleppo hanging out where the Marines hang out at the, you know, U.S. Embassy. We don't spend all of our time in the Sheraton Hotel because, one, that's where you're going to get in trouble. Two, it's also going to cost about $120 a night to stay there, right? And we keep a low profile. We mind our own business. We're the guests of the Syrian government, and we have their total protection. In fact, it was sort of interesting to discover in the middle of the summer that two of our workmen, I don't even know if I told the story to Horst, two of our workmen belonged to the Mohabarat, to the Syrian FBI. And what happened was I found that out because I fired them. They weren't working very hard. I'd hired them as just normal workmen, and they weren't doing the pick and shovel work very well. And I fired them, and later on that evening, they came back with an official of the Mohabarat who said, "Now, Dr. Mike, you can't fire these two guys because they're watching you." Well, they're not only watching to make sure that Horus doesn't walk away with the treasure of King Tut, but also to make sure that nothing happens to us. We're very carefully monitored, and we're very careful to mind our P's and Q's. So I've worked in the Middle East now for the past 10 years. Indeed, I was even in Egypt when Sadat was assassinated and all heck broke loose then. But if you use your head, and if you carefully control where you're going and what you do, it's no problem at all. You're very safe. There are lots of foreigners in this part of Syria. The UCLA crew had 30 people. There was around the same size crew working from Yale University. There's a bigger crew than us in terms of Canadians right now working in the area. No one's had any difficulties. No one's had any problems. We don't necessarily wave an American flag over the place and play the Star Spangled Banner every morning. We keep a low profile. And so far, our relationships in all levels, from the workmen all the way to the top of the government, has been very, very good. And the question on how many of you guys want to come, I know hinges somewhat on the cost. Let me be real upfront about cost with you. The biggest chunk of the cost is the airplane ticket. A round-trip ticket's $1,000, you know, give or take whatever the airlines is going to be prorating or discounting. Now, one-way ticket's only $500, but I couldn't get anyone to go on that, right? Everybody wants that round trip. And last year, we flew on Swiss Air. Awfully, awfully nice. Now, we could go Air Pakistan and save $100. They fly once a week, and they guarantee to lose your luggage. What do you think, guys? Swiss Air or Air Pakistan? Well, we use either Swiss Air or Lufthansa. Those are the two really good, reliable carriers. They're both about $1,000 for a round-trip ticket. On top of that, we have a $500 charge for room and board. And let me tell you, the food, to get the food is expensive for us. Syria has shortages of everything. And when we show up, I immediately have to go to the black market and I have to start haggling for sugar, for rice, for coffee, for tea, toilet paper. Everything's in short supply in Syria. And we don't want the people on the dig to be in short supply, but it is expensive to provide the food and to provide good drinking water. And so there's a basically top cost is $1,500. You're going to want to have a couple hundred dollars spending money. Because you get over there and there's all these things that your Aunt Susie would love to have and your sister Jane would like this, and the prices on stuff is great. But you need to have at least $150, $200 just so that you can enjoy the summer and not watch everyone else go shopping to light and say, gee, I wish I had something to spend on it. So that's the cost that is there that has to be dealt with. One of the things that I oftentimes do is people who come back a second time, we prorate the cost. Because when you go over the first time, you're a greenhorn. And Horace and I have to straighten you out and teach you the ropes and make sure you get all those forms and tags done right. The second time you come back, you know all those things, and you're able to help us with some of the other students. So people who are coming back, we oftentimes try to cut some of that cost for them. Nobody gets a salary, not even me or Nethery on the project. In fact, we turn out to be a couple of the big donors also in terms of time and money. Just off of bat, you're not committed. How many of you think you might be interested in coming this summer? Oh, that'd be great. That'd really be super. I'm hoping that we're going to have a crew of around 15 to 18 people. That's about the maximum number that we have beds for and places at the dinner table with. And my hope is to have at least a good 5 or 6 students from here at the seminary, 5 or 6 from the community college, then to make up the others as a smattering of other educational schools around the area in the Midwest. Who else has a question? You want to know what time we have to get up in the morning? Real early, right? We get you up before the sun rises. We're there on the edge digging as soon as the first light comes up. We take a break about 9 o'clock in the morning. We go down and have a really nice, what we call second breakfast. Scrambled eggs, cucumbers, tomatoes, peanut butter and jelly, a little bit of tea. 30 minutes later, I'm yelling at you. We get you back up on that tell. We're working again until 12 to 12:30. We dig 6 days a week. I'll be real honest with you, it's not a vacation. Don't say, hey, this is a great way to spend my vacation. Nah, go to the Bahamas or, you know, go to Switzerland or go to someplace pleasant. We work very hard. It's not sort of a play around dig. We've got a real serious set of objectives, and we've got a really top notch, number one type site. Of the 30 major archaeological sites in Syria, Tuna is one of the 30. And so we don't want to do a poor job on it. We want to make sure we come away with really good documentation. The site's full of lots of exciting things. Come help us take some of them out of the ground. Thanks.
Maybe I just should remind you that if you are interested, I have a sign-up sheet in the ante room to my office, as I've been advertising regularly in the daily announcements. No obligation for that, but if you signed it up, why then we'll follow it up with you and hope you can come with us. Maybe I will just add to what Mike had that in addition to plenty of drinking water, he also provides us with plenty of other fluids to drink as well.
Let me, in fact, that's a good story. Horace, I promised Horace
that if he came over, we'd have something other than orange soda and water for him to drink. And we showed up, and they just said, boy, there's none of that B-R around here. And so we started checking around, and we found out that the governor of the province where we were staying had 3 cases of beer. And it was in his private storage area. And we traded 3 cartons of Marlboro cigarettes, 2 t-shirts, and $20 to come away with all the beer in northeastern Syria. And when other excavations would come to visit us, their just eyes would bug out when they'd open the refrigerator and there'd be a cold one in there. And so we try to provide as many of the comforts as reasonably possible.